Hi, everybody. Thanks for checking out Telich Talks. My guest this week is Nate Ulrich. He's a veteran sports reporter, a features writer, an enterprise sports reporter who spent 12 seasons as the beat reporter at the Akron Beacon Journal. And on the beat, day to day, the Cleveland Browns of the National Football League, one of the toughest beats there is in the league. He's a Kent State University grad. And on the pod, we talked about what it takes to define what is a great story, then how do you go about getting it done. And if you're a Browns fan, you'll be interested to hear his takes on the likes of Joe Thomas, Nick Chubb, and more of the day-to-day grind, what it takes to be a beat reporter in the National Football League. We also have features on the Nance family. You know, the legendary former Cavalier, Larry Nance Sr. Well, two of his sons now have been members of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Larry Jr. played for several years, and now young Pete is on the roster as well. Also, he talked about writing stories about Donovan Mitchell and a real intriguing piece on Akron Buchtel coach Rayshon Dent. Here is my interview with Nate Ulrich of the Akron Beacon Journal. Nate, it is great to have you on, and I've always been curious about your journalistic background. When the bugle sounded for journalism, how old were you, and how did you react to it, and what kind of got you going?
Well, John, first of all, thanks for having me on. I've listened to a bunch of your podcast episodes and really enjoy them. So it's a real honor for me to be on here with you.
Thank you.
The way this all started for me was actually I was a junior in high school. I'm born and raised in Akron, and I'm with the Firestone on the west side. And, you know, I played football in high school and loved the game. And I love sports in general, always had. Well, one day we had a career fair at the school, and Larry Pantages, longtime Beacon Journal sports editor, showed up. His daughter was a classmate of mine. And Larry was there to tell kids, like, you know, hey, this is what I do. And, you know, this is kind of, you know, the path to follow if you want to go into journalism. And, you know, I just got it in my head, you know, wow, I've always kind of had a knack for, you know, writing in English. Creative writing, like even in middle school, you know, I was in competitions and stuff like that. They're called Power to 10. So I was always kind of, you know, interested in writing and, of course, sports. So to marry the two, I thought seemed like a really good idea. And back then when I was, whatever, 16, 17 years old, I mean, the thought of just going to, you know, a bunch of, you know, NFL or NBA or whatever it is, MLB games for free as part of your job just really appealed to me. So I really kind of started like with the idea, like, I just want to go to all the games. You know, that was kind of where it started. And then Larry's such a nice guy. And, you know, we got to talking and, you know, a couple of years later when I was in college, I went to Kent State, and early on there, I got the foot in the door, which we all know is huge key in you know, the media business.
Yeah. Huge.
Whether it's, you know, TV side like you, John, or newspaper or whatever it may be, get the foot in the door one way or another. And back then, you know, the Beacon Journal had a big staff and they staffed their sports department every night with probably, you know, 5 to 10, you know, high school or college age people who took box scores.
Got
and,
it.
You know, did the agate, you know, got all the scores and all the standings, everything in the paper. And that's how I started. I started taking, you know, phone calls for high school box, box scores, you know, just, you know, whatever, I don't know, 3-4 days a week. And was able to eventually parlay that into writing and really haven't looked back since.
Well, so what was your first thing you actually wrote? Did someone else assist you with it? Or was it a game story from a high school game or what?
Yeah, I think it was a high school basketball game story. And I really had no idea what I was doing. And that's kind of the way it goes, as I found out over the years. Like, you hear often, like, nobody really teaches you how to do this business. You know, of course, you have mentors, and I have some great ones. But when you first kind of start out and you don't know everybody and, you know, you're just trying to kind of figure it out as you go, like, I would just go in there as a, I think, 19-year-old at the time and just kind of winging it. And so learned a lot of lessons early on and like, oh, if you're going to cover a high school basketball game, you should buy a score book like the one that they have at the scores table. And you should have a legal pad in addition to that. And you should track a play-by-play and all the stats in the scorebook. Things like that weren't really like, obvious to me at first. And you just learn. And then once you kind of go through it and, you get some more opportunities, you get obviously better and better and better. And then you kind of figure it out. But at first, yeah, I'm not, I mean, there's, I was totally lost. And I remember asking, like, okay, so what exactly do you guys want from me? And it was like, well, just go cover the game, So it's kind of like that sink or swim thing. So apparently I did enough to kind of get some more opportunities. And then I think eventually got the hang of it.
Okay, you got the hang of it and you felt more and more comfortable writing stuff. So take me through the journey from that moment to when you were seasoned enough and have had the credibility enough to become the beat writer for the paper for the Cleveland Browns, which is no small beat to have, especially in Northeast Ohio.
Yeah, well, so the way that worked out was the Beacon did a really good thing back then. They had a they call it student correspondent position, and it wasn't just sports. Sports had one, and then other areas of the newsroom had one, like the features department had one. The
Gotcha.
metro department had, I think, a couple. They might have had a, I think copy desk had one too. And basically it was an internship, but that's what they called student correspondent. So four or five positions at a time. And you worked full-time hours and you got a staff writer byline, as opposed to special to the Beacon Journal, a correspondent byline. You were
Got it.
part of the staff. You weren't on, full wage salary or anything like that. But you were getting the experience, and you were getting the opportunities and the workload. And so I was fortunate enough to do that as a senior in college and really had that for a full year. And then it was a thing like, okay, I'm graduating. Am I going to stay in that role?
Yeah.
Am I going to, go somewhere else? And really, the management at the time really was very high on, kind of the homegrown journalist leaving the Beacon
Oh, okay.
and experiencing something else before they could work for the Beacon,
Okay.
full time. So, that's the path I took. And I remember it's funny, John, because it was like one of those things where I could continue to be the student correspondent if I were taking college classes, but I graduated from Kent State and I was kind of in limbo for a minute. I actually picked up a Spanish class at the University of Akron and I was going to just take that so I could keep the gig going for a while I looked for something. Well, I was probably in like three classes into this Spanish class when I get a call, my application hit with somebody. And it was the Times of Northwest Indiana. I had met their managing editor at a career fair in Detroit, and he took my application back, and other people at the office liked it. They were looking to hire somebody in sports. And so I had an opportunity to go interview. And I remember telling the Spanish teacher, hey, just to let you know, like, nothing against you. I think you're a good teacher. I really want to learn Spanish and need to. But if I get this full-time job, I'm not going to be back. And then I never saw him again because things moved quickly. I went out there to Northwest Indiana, which is, pretty close to Chicago. It's right there on the papers in Munster, Indiana, on the very close to the Illinois-Indiana border. So, you can get to Chicago in a half hour. You can take a train in. It's a nice place to be. So ended up working out there for like 2.5 years and really a lot of great experience. Their bread and butter is high school sports, local stuff, their guys go to the pros, whatever, they're all over it, and had a really good staff, really good paper. And I was able to work like the way I was kind of a hybrid job, but they called me a sports enterprise reporter. So I was able to do a bunch of different stories, kind of anything to do with sports, all sports across the board. And also had one day a week where I did like the desk shift and helped put out the paper and was, kind of in charge a little bit, in terms of putting out the section with the designer. And that was invaluable experience too, because it just gave me a different perspective on the business, not just writing, but also like, what does it take, you know, what is it like for the person on the other end who's getting all this copy and working with the designer and all that? And so I just think any kind of, you know, vantage point you can gain is valuable. And so that helped me too. And then, you know, I kept in touch with all the folks at the Beacon, and, you know, eventually, some things changed where some people had left. They had a couple openings, and this was in 2010. Jason Lloyd and I were actually interviewing and trying to go for, you know, a job at the Beacon, and thought, you know, we both had done well. We both, you know, I had heard a lot about Jason. I didn't know him at the time, and we knew that the feedback was good. I had good feedback, and I knew they thought highly of him. So I thought it was going to be one of us. By some miracle, and it doesn't happen often in this business, because jobs are hard to come by, they hire us both on the same exact day.
That is wild. That's
So,
exceptionally wild.
you're right. So I got the Browns beat, he got the Cavs beat. And, you know, I spent 12 seasons as the, you know, everyday Browns beat writer, had a great time. And one thing I got to say, and I try to say it whenever I can, but Browns fans would never know, you know, unless they're in Berea, which, you know, that sometimes we see people tour the facility and things like that. But unless you're in that media room, you don't really realize it's a really close-knit beat. So
Yes.
I say that because I got the beat when I was 25, and there's a lot of veteran reporters in there who've done it a long time, very accomplished, very great at their jobs, you know, and to have that group really embrace me and not just kind of show me the ropes, but to become really lifelong friends with a bunch of them was a real blessing. So I'm very grateful to, you know, Mary Kay Cabot and Scott Petrak and Tom Withers, people who had been there long before
Tremendous people.
I
Great
was.
pros.
Yeah, and great at their jobs. And so, of course, a very influential mentor to me and figure in my career is Marla Ridenour, and she was
Yeah,
instrumental.
Marla.
But when, you know, I worked with Marla, obviously, at the Beacon for a long time. But I think it says something about the other folks in that room to be able to kind of step out and, like, you know, I wasn't their coworker. You know, we didn't work for the same news outlet, but they still, you know, welcome me with open arms. And so I'll be forever grateful to that group.
What a way that you got the entrance into that small world, because it really kind of is a small world with Mary Kay and with Tom and with all the other beat writers that and the media, the broadcast folks and what have you. So you jump in there. It's 2010. This was Big Mike coming in as the head honcho, Mike Holmgren, or was that 2010 year?
Yeah, he was there. He was already there. It was the second and final season of Eric Mangini as the head coach.
Okay, you
Yeah,
got Eric.
so yes. So that was the year that Mike Holmgren essentially kind of wasted, because, you know, he it wasn't going to work between him and Mangini. We all knew the writing was on the wall stylistically, philosophically. It just wasn't a marriage. But the old coach and Mike thought, hey, the Browns won the last four games of the 2009 season with Eric Mangini. I don't feel like firing a guy under those circumstances. So he kept them. And, you know, then it was a year later, they were splitting.
Well, there was a lot of folks back in those days that were very critical of Mike, felt that he, didn't apply himself as much. When you're in the midst of the beat per se, can you really make those assumptions, or do you just have to take everything at face value as you're going forward?
I think you just have to be there every day and, you know, try to get the best sense for what the truth is. And that's way easier said than done, because even if you're there every day, you're not there. You know, the walls are put up. But, you know, I got to tell you, there's a lot of hot takes, as we know. And there's a lot of that kind of talk going back to that regime with the Browns, but carried all the way through. And, you know, I don't fault anybody, like sports talk radio hosts. They have a job, it's to be entertaining. I get it. But I basically try, you know, the coaches and players always say ignore the outside noise. I try to do that to a large extent. with Sports Talk Radio because I feel like, you know, I have a better chance being there every day when I'm the beat writer to really know what's going on and not to be influenced by, you know, some of those hot takes. Again, no disrespect to the medium. It's just they're there to entertain and, you know, to have these opinions, and they do it for hours on end. And, you know, it's day after day after day, and they've got to keep it, you know, spicy. It's got to entertain. It's got to, they, you know, they're after the ratings, obviously. So I try to, throughout my time, you know, take everything into account, but really try to find out for myself. And what I've done in recent years too, and this is relevant to your podcast, is I really listen to podcasts all the time. You know, Scott Petrak has a podcast that he does with Dave Chudowski, and Scott's there every day and has been for a long time. And Mary Kay Lobby and Ashley Bastock do a podcast. So I'm talking about Brown's podcast. Zach Jackson does a podcast all the time with The Athletic. Daryl Ryder, yes, you can hear him on Sports Talk Radio. And unlike the hosts, you know, of those shows who have to, you know, entertain no matter what, Daryl's brought on the air. He's the guy who's there every day. I mean, Daryl grinds nonstop. But I can hear Daryl on his podcast, you know, so I can go. So I just think that if you want a better pulse of the team as a fan or media member or whatever, go to the podcast, because those people are there every single day and they're very well informed. And they know what's going on, and you're going to get greater insight into the team that way. So really, I used to listen, like, in the car, Sports Talk Radio all the time, anytime I was driving, but now it's all podcasts for me. I've really switched over to podcasts, and I think it's a great way to kind of stay in touch. And it's not just the Browns. Now that I'm paying attention to every team, you know, I listen to them across the board. I mean, there's some great ones. Chris Fedor was a Cavs one. With Ethan Sands, a new guy over there at cleveland.com, that's like daily now. I mean, and so I'm always tuning into that. I'm always listening to that. Another thing too is I'm always listening to anytime anybody speaks publicly. You know, I think if you can stay informed, even if you aren't there every day, now that I bounce around, I'm not, but I'm always listening to every single interview that I can get my hands on from all the teams, because that way, you know, I can kind of stay connected as much as possible.
Nate, I know we've had discussions with other folks in the media about, you know, the Browns beat or the fortunes of the Browns. And, you know, everybody assuming that the folks on the beat or in the media loves it when they're not playing well, because it's more, you know, more food for talk and those types of things. But please confirm for me that the atmosphere is so much better when things are on the up and up, and the, maybe the stories might not be as juicy per se, but you know, day in and day out, it just has to be less of a weighing on your psyche covering a team that's perennially good versus one that goes 1-31.
Oh, there's no doubt that I think that's the biggest misconception among fans. I don't know another beat writer or, you know, somebody who's with the team on a regular basis and from a media standpoint who wants the team to fail, because what you said is exactly right. The access is so much better when a team is succeeding, okay? Because people want to talk about success, you know?
Yeah.
They're open to sharing their stories more often than not. They're open to, you know, kind of letting you inside and knocking down those walls a little bit that I was talking about earlier. When it's bad, it's in terms of the record, it's bad in terms of the access, it's bad in terms of the interviews, people aren't in a good mood. And, you know, it can become exhausting to try to, you know, plow your way through that. You know, vibe in the building and that mood. And I was definitely in it for a long time with the Browns, you know, the 1-31 stretch. You know, those are not pleasant times to cover a team. So the other thing is, you know, just like analytics affects the Browns and other professional sports teams so much now, analytics affects what I do so much now. Every story we write is tracked, and You know, we find out how many people read a given story, how long they read it for.
Yeah.
And that matters. I mean, it used to be, you know, you would write something, it would show up on somebody's doorstep or in their driveway, and you would have no idea. Like, you would get some feedback via email and things like that. But for the, by and large, you would have no idea how that really did and how much interest it really generated. So the analytics tell us now, and everything, you know, in terms of the web traffic, everything is monitored very closely. And when teams are winning and, you know, stories, you know, are cranked out about, you know, positive, you know, successful seasons, guess what? Those numbers go up across the board. So again, that's better for our jobs. You know, I want the Beacon Journal and other news organizations in Northeast Ohio and throughout the country to remain relevant, to keep operating. Like, nobody wants the business to close. So, like, you want the stories to do well, and the stories do best when teams are doing well. So, yeah, it's a complete myth and that sports writers want teams to fail. I don't get it at all. I think that, you know, the general accusation is just like, oh, you guys love drama in the media.
Yeah.
But I think what's more kind of attractive than, you know, a dramatic storyline is a successful team that makes the job easier, lets you tell stories more often and better, and therefore your product is being consumed more.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. And it's a real delicate fine line that you have to walk from, you know, you have your day-to-day job to do, you're pleasant with all the people that you're around, but you do have to ask them, as you've done on many occasions, those delicate and difficult questions. And that's part of being a journalist. And the other thing that I respect the most is the folks that are really in the media, that deal with the players day in and day out, do write uncomfortable things or say uncomfortable things on the air, but you're there the next day, and you're there the day after, and the day after that, and you're exposing yourself to that particular player or subset of the team that you may have been critical towards. And I think in this day and age, with the way the media is being consumed, and there's a lot of people that are kind of not really media members, but the public thinks they are, they don't deal with what you deal with day in and day out, or Mary Kay does, or Grossi does, or Tom Withers and what have you. And I think people have to know that. That's why I'm kind of beat the drum in making this statement, that there is a difference between the people that are there every day as legitimate, you know, members of the journalist society, if you will. You feel that way as well, Nate?
Yeah, there is, because it's all about respect, right? Yeah, you might have to write something critical because people make mistakes. Everybody's human. And, you know, whether it's an off the field or off the court mistake, or, you know, something that happens within a game and a performance, a decision made by an executive or a coach, obviously part of the job is covering it, chronicling it, asking questions about it, even if, you know, they are kind of uncomfortable at times. So I think that the key there is what you're touching on, that you're critical as a journalist of the performance, of the decision, of the move, without, you know, making it a personal attack. And I think that most people, you know, in, you know, the positions of power, you know, GM, coach, I think they understand that comes with the territory. Now, sometimes people will take exception to certain, you know, line of questioning or, you know, reporting anyway. But I think that most, by and large, people will respect, like you said, if you're doing the job the right way, if your intentions are good, and if you are trying to be fair, but also trying to, you know, hold them accountable because you feel like it's your job. I think most of the time, and maybe it doesn't happen right away, but eventually I think that everybody kind of understands, you know, that that is part of the job of a journalist. They may not like it all the time.
Right.
And obviously, as a journalist, I may not like it all the time. But there are certain situations that arise, and you have to, you know, handle them because, you know, it's what you signed up for.
Well, now you, of course, within the last couple of years have moved over to doing not just Brown stuff, but, you know, enterprise reporting, feature writing, and you've got a great knack for that and a great talent. So what I would like to do now, if we can, Nate, is chat a little bit about some of the stories that you've written. They'll both be Browns related and or not Browns related, because you've done it all in your dozen years on the beat, plus now in your enterprise role. And I'm going to start with something that you're working on right now, because we're doing an interview on a Friday afternoon, and we actually pushed back a little bit. People should know this. It's a very fluid job that you have. We pushed back the interview because you were working on a story about the third member of the Nance family joining the Cavaliers. And that's Pete Nance. So take us through the, kind of the dynamics of how that goes, gets put together.
Well, first of all, I think that the Nance family is awesome because they're great people. And the thing that's really fascinating about them is, you know, when the Cavs played in Richfield, and now we're at 30 years, John, since the Cavs stopped playing in Richfield and started playing in downtown
it's
Cleveland.
Insane. Yep.
1994, right? So
yes.
I think the great thing about the Nances is that there was a special relationship that the Cavs players who played in Richfield had with Summit County and with Akron. And because I'm an Akron kid through and through, that's just nostalgia that I'll never get tired of. And I'm of the age where those late 80s, early 90s Cavs teams with Larry Nance and Brad Doherty, Mark Price, Craig Elo, Hot Rod Williams, coached by Lenny Wilkins. That's my wheelhouse. I mean, those teams were, you know, really talented, really good. Obviously, Michael Jordan stood in the way most of the time. And they never got to the finals, but had many great seasons and runs and very good talent and coaching, a likable group. Those guys were all around here. I mean, I've talked to a bunch of them recently. And, you know, the Fairlawn, Hudson, you know, those are the communities that these guys called home. And of all of them, the guy who stayed was Larry Nance. And what's interesting is he and his wife, Janie, met in Phoenix because Larry played for the Suns and then got traded to the Cavs. And Larry's from the South. So then he went to Phoenix. He came here and, like, he had never, this is fitting because I just drove through the snow to talk to his son. He had never driven in snow before until he got here.
Yeah.
And I had just had a conversation about a week, maybe 10 days ago, with him and Janie. And I said, had you ever driven in snow? Because you're from the South and you played in Phoenix before you came here. And they met in Phoenix. And he said, no, I haven't. And she said, I've never heard anyone asking that. I've never even asked him that. And she was like, wow, that's crazy. We've never talked about that. And I said, that's just me being curious. And that curiosity is really what drives me to continue to tell these stories, because it's just part of my nature. Like, I think of things like that and want to know. And Larry Nance was a childhood hero of mine. So anything like about him is still interesting to me. And despite the weather, because they both to this day do not like it, I'm from here and don't like it, they love the area. They love the people they connected with it. And when it came time, Larry had a bad knee. It was time to retire. It kind of ended abruptly. They just decided to stay. They have a house in Bath Township, and they raised all three of their children there, and they all went to Revere High School and graduated from there. So that would be Casey Nance, their daughter, who I did cover a little bit in high school, really good player. And then I was off doing, I think in Indiana, doing, you know, the enterprise stuff in another state, gaining that experience, I think, and did not cover Larry Jr. But Larry Jr. obviously, you know, played for Revere and then went on. And now he, you know, obviously we know he played with the Cavs just like his father. And now he's with the New Orleans Pelicans. And I've caught up with him in my new role a couple of times, including like a month ago when he came into Cleveland. And now his brother Pete just signed that 10-day contract with the Cavs. So it really is such a cool story because, you know, Pete's, you know, right on the doorstep of making an appearance with the Cavs. And it'll be a father and two sons and just complete this circle. And the fact that both sons were raised in Northeast Ohio, you know, because their dad was a Cavs legend and stayed here because he just connected with the community to such a great degree that he didn't want to leave. He and Janie went back to Phoenix during his Cavs career. They still had a house there. They went back, but Janie explained to me that it just didn't feel the same. It didn't feel right. They weren't at home anymore. And so they came back here. They built a condo and then eventually moved into that house in Bath Township where they're still living. And since then, Larry Jr. has built a house in Bath Township, which his mom tells me is like an 8 minute, like 8 minutes away from the family's original home. Cool. And that he has like an apartment above a garage, and that's where Pete is staying now. So he, you know, Larry's with his family. Larry Jr. has his own family. You know, he's married. He's in New Orleans or the New Orleans area. And then Pete is there taking care of the new Nance house in Bath Township, driving Larry's car. Larry told me he's not charging him rent, but he's making him take care of his wife's plants. And it's just such a cool story about great people who stayed here when, you know, that's pretty rare. You know, it doesn't always happen if you're not from here. You don't always stay here. And I understand. But these people did. They saw the special aspects of this community and the people. They just connected with the people. They loved the people. And they just decided to make it home. And so to see it all come full circle for the Nance family has been really fun.
It's very, very awesome to see that whole dynamic that the family has with Northeast Ohio and where they live. I mean, Bath Township, real close to the Cuyahoga Valley National Park, some of the greatest spots, you know, one of the most visited national parks that we have in America. And it's right here, you know, on your doorstep, as it were. It's so awesome. And a little bit of a personal note, I'm so involved with the Greater Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame. And a couple of years ago, we put Larry Sr. and Z Zadrunas into the Hall of Fame that night. And he was just so tickled pink, and it was so awesome. And that doesn't happen if he didn't, as you said in your piece and just said to me on this podcast, taken such a liking and put his roots down in Northeast Ohio, because that is one of the criteria for our Hall of Fame, to be either a resident if you're not from here after your playing career. And that's what he exemplified. So they're wonderful people. I hope that, you know, Pete flourishes. It's going to be fun to watch that. I'm sure there'll be more stuff that you will be writing about him. Another story that you wrote this year, the basketball success at Buchtel High School, and Rayshon Dent, the head coach. What a inspiring guy this is. Tell us what makes him inspiring, and why was he so open to you about his past?
Well, he is an amazing guy. And he's beloved in that community. He's Buchtel through and through. He went there as a student. And what inspires me about him is, well, many things, but I'm going to start with this. There's so many times when we're talking about, you know, how I started in journalism and things like that, there's so many times where you're going to get rejected, right? I mean, I applied for all kinds of jobs that I didn't get. And I'm sure everybody listening has been through something where you think you would really be a good fit. You think you're qualified and you don't even get an interview. Okay. Yeah. So let me tell you about Rayshon Dent. Despite being a Buchtel guy, like, you know, 1040 Copley Road all the way, he got rejected not once, but twice for that job. And it wasn't until over the course of like two decades coaching with them And he actually left and came back, and he also coached football and was part of a state title appearance as an offensive coordinator. A lot on the resume that said he should have gotten a really good look, if not the job, way earlier. But he didn't, and he never stopped trying. And I asked him, you know, some people would just say forget it, and he said, I just love Buchtel that much, and if I didn't get the job, I would be at the games anyway. And furthermore, I didn't want to give them that out. I did not want to give administration the excuse that, you know, oh, we were going to hire him this time, you know, third time's a charm. We were going to hire him, but he didn't apply. He didn't interview. Well, guess what? He was persistent, and it paid off, and he got the job. And a few seasons after he got the job, they won the first state championship in school history. And now Buchtel, if you know anything about Akron, if you know anything about high school sports, if you know anything about Buchtel, Buchtel is famous and very well respected for just having great athletic talent, great coaching. I mean, there's so many really high caliber players who have come through Buchtel, you know. Sure. NBA guys, NFL guys, and they have won state championships in football, but to never have one in basketball, and for this guy who had been rejected multiple times to be the one to bring it home for his beloved alma mater, I think is so cool. And then another thing, and I want to tell you, because I think the sausage making of stories can be really fun.
Yeah.
One thing when it comes to figuring out this business and how to do this job is, and from my perspective, is interviewing. Okay.
Yep.
There, and I had a lot of good professors at Kent State and some people who really helped me become better. But there really wasn't like one class that I ever took dedicated to the art of interviewing. And it really is an art, and it takes time. And, you know, like everything in sports, with reps, you get better. And I think I certainly have grown a lot as an interviewer over the years. But one trick that I did learn over the years, I think it was from a Kent State professor named Barb Hipsman. So give a shout out to Barb if I can. She was a great newspaper lady who became a professor there. And she always had this thing like, okay, sometimes the best quote you get or the best story you get from somebody when you're interviewing is like when the interview's done and you're walking to the car and you're, you know, it's just, her point was to close it out with, hey, is there anything that we didn't go over? Is there anything that we didn't talk about? You know, is there anything we didn't touch on? What did we miss? And most times, I would say 90% or more times I do that. It's become a habit.
Yeah.
They'll say, well, no, I think we went over everything. I think we checked all the boxes or, you know, whatever. I can't think of anything else. But when I was sitting with Ray Chandon, and he, you know, I had gotten to know him over the course of a year or so, and he knew we were going to, that I wanted to sit down with him. And after the state title, he was finally ready to tell a story, to answer one of your questions. I think that kind of lifted a weight off him. Look at what we've accomplished at Buchtel, and now I'm ready to tell my story. And we went through a bunch of stuff, and I knew he was really interesting because of the rejection he had received and his football background. He had even coached LeBron James and Pee Wee, tailback, the quarterback, all this stuff. But the most interesting thing about him came because I said, hey, is there anything we missed? Like almost 2 hours into an interview at Wally Waffle. And Ray Sean said, well, I've never really told you my life story, my background. And then that opened up a whole new window into him telling me that when he was just a baby, his mom was shot and killed by a neighbor lady. Yep. And just the ripple effect that caused for the family and for Ray Sean, that now he's a man in his 50s and he looks back and how that shaped his life, how his father struggled with it, how he had to learn a lot of hard life lessons because he was basically born into this situation. I mean, he was in diapers when it happened. How he had to learn how to deal with anger, and now he found a path to forgive this woman who shot his mom. That's all stuff that he's able to share with his players now. And there are a lot of players who he's dealt with who he suspects have been involved with gangs, And he says, you know, they never really tell you up front, but, you know, they kind of talk in code to let you know what's going on. And, you know, a lot of kids come from single parent households. And a lot of kids have a rough upbringing. And Rayshon is really able to use his own life story and tell them that. He's very transparent with that and to connect with them through that, because his point is, hey, you can open up to me. You can tell me what you're going through. I can help you because I can relate to any of it, because this is how I was brought up. And this is a situation I found myself in as a kid. And it's really resonated with his players. He's told the last couple of teams that he's coached about this story and about his upbringing, about the circumstances. And he's gotten such good response with it. And he's been able to change some lives. Not just because of that, he has throughout the years, but I think he thinks that it has been a useful tool in helping him connect that way and being that positive influence for a lot of kids who need it. And with the success of the team in the state championship, I think he was finally able to kind of get it off his chest so more people can know about this inspirational story. And it's not just limited to the close circle of his own players.
No, that's really cool that you were able to get, you know, that out of him. And again, good reporting comes from spending time and really, you know, using those two ears and listening to what is said, or maybe listening for something that's not said, and then having that, you know, spidey sense, if you will, to get them to open up about, and to him to say, you know, about the violence that that did in his mother. And then how he now to this day, isn't he saying, I don't want you if you're involved. If you're involved with some kind of a gang, no place on this basketball team. So I think it, you know, it points out to other kids at Book Duel or wherever, that he knows, he understands, and to move that forward. I mentioned the word Spidey, so I'm going to make a transition here to a guy that plays for the Cavaliers. You've done a nice takeout piece on Donovan Mitchell, Spider-Man, you know, and tell our listeners, you know, some of the unique aspects of what makes this guy such a, not just a hell of a player, heck of a player, but a good dude, a good guy with his teammates and what have you.
Well, it's so funny because the process of that story was, it took a lot of persistence, speaking of Rayshon then and that quality. Because here's what happened. When I sat down with Donovan Mitchell, I knew I wanted to do a story about his nickname because I hadn't really seen a deep dive into it. Everybody knew his nickname was Spider. And
yeah, Spider-Man.
You know, you had Myles Garrett and other people in the Cleveland sports scene tweeting emojis of spiders when they made the blockbuster trade with the Jazz to get Donovan Mitchell here.
Yep.
And so people like the nickname. I love the nickname. I liked Spider-Man growing up. And I thought it was really cool because, you know, Donovan Mitchell's in a commercial for a Spider-Man movie with Tom Holland. Like, he's made his shoes into Spider-Man shoes. Like, he's really taken this thing and run with it. He's had fun with it, and it's become part of his brand. So I really wanted to explore the nickname and the origin story behind it. But here's where things got a little bit tricky. When I sat down with Donovan Mitchell, he got this nickname as a kid when he was in, you know, New York AAU scene. So yeah. I don't blame him. It would be easy. There's little things that I forget from my childhood. I know the story and everything, but there's one detail. He told me the name of the man who gave him the nickname because I was obsessed with finding this guy. He told me his name was Al Harris. His name was actually Al Taylor.
Oh.
So finding him in the New York area, because he's in New Jersey now, with a name like that, a very common name, either way, Harris or Taylor. And I didn't know that it was Taylor for a long time. It took a lot of digging to find out I had the wrong name. That took a long time. I don't know how long. Weeks, maybe a month to figure out that I had the wrong name and to finally get this guy on the phone. But I knew that it would never be the story I wanted it to be if I didn't get the guy who nicknamed him. So it was kind of crazy, but through talking, and he was on multiple AAU teams, which made it harder, right? And this is almost 20 years ago. So I'm trying to track down people and finding their name. There's not like a roster you can pull up. Like, he played with some guys, including Ty Jerome, who's with the Cavs now. He's been out with an ankle injury, but he's one of those former AAU teammates of Donovan. And there's another guy in the, who had made it to the NBA. So, you know, that there's some kind of some clues or whatever with them. And if you Google enough stories and search enough archives on them and Donovan, maybe you can piece something together. So eventually I was able to find some of the old coaches slash fathers of the AAU team. And they eventually, they at first, the first kind of group that I talked to went along with the Al Harris idea. Eventually, someone corrected me and said, it's Al Taylor. And then that kind of opened up the floodgates, and I was able to find the name of his son, Al Taylor's son, who was a teammate of Donovan's. And I called the son, and we talked. And then I thought, uh-oh, I might hit a dead end, because the son said he doesn't talk to his father anymore. Now, to his credit, to this young man's credit, he's in his 20s, Donovan's age. To his credit, he said, you know what? You're trying to tell a cool story. This is bigger than me and what I have going on in my personal life. I'm going to give you his number. And he gave
That's
me,
cool.
And he hooked me up with his dad. And, you know, I was able to talk to him about the nickname and everything like that. And it's just a cool story to me, because this guy – he was an old school basketball guy who used to give everybody on the team nicknames, you know, but not everybody became Donovan Mitchell. And look what the nickname represents now. And it's so cool because, you know, Donovan's not a giant in the NBA. He's like 6'2", 6'3", but he just got some really long arms, and the way he uses them and the acrobatic way that he moves, and he almost hangs in the air like Spider-Man as he adjusts at times to make shots. And also just the way he can use his arms on defense. That was actually the origin of the nickname, was because he kept stealing the ball from these guys at the top of the key. It almost looked like he had, you know, eight limbs because of how he would just get that ball no matter what. And so it was just a fun window into kind of a background story, a personality. I think Donovan is a really good guy. I think he's very well liked by his teammates. I think he's a very good leader. And the people I was talking to in New York who knew him growing up, of course, they're all big Knicks fans. They know he was a big Knicks fan. They wanted him with the Knicks. They know he thought he was going to the Knicks. And the Cavs were about to play the Knicks in the playoffs. And obviously, we know how it went. We know the Knicks took care of the Cavs, and it was a disappointing end for the Cavs. But everybody was just – before that playoff series, and I'm still sure, everybody I talked to, they were just devastated that he wasn't with the Knicks. They just wanted him with the Knicks. And Donovan said all the right things. You know, obviously it would be a dream come true for anybody to play for their hometown team and everything. But the way he behaves since the trade, I really admire. There's all kinds of speculation about him wanting out, swirling nonstop. And it goes back to that thing you were asking earlier, John, like, what's the difference between how a guy is actually acting and comporting himself versus what talk radio says he thinks and all that? Yep. I can't read his mind, but I know that he's all, you know, from every interaction, every time he's answered a question, and the actions speak louder than words. He has led, and he has been very professional and been all business. And I think that he's really handled himself in a good way that, you know, his teammates respect and his coaches respect. So whether he leaves or not, that's not really, you know, that's not something that we'll know until, you know, something happens with the unresolved contractual issue. But I do think that, you know, he's giving the Cavs all he has right now.
Yeah, he really is. And as we're recording this, they're playing very good basketball without two of their big guys. And it's just been fun to see that. It's going to also be fun just to see, you know, Pete Nance getting a little bit of a sniff of what it's like to be on that roster and going forward. Let's go to a guy that we all universally love, Pro Football Hall of Famer Joe Thomas. You covered a good chunk of Joe's career. And I think one of the long takeouts that you did about Joe was two things. Track and field background enabled him to be so good at pass blocking. That's part of it. And the other part was how in the latter stages of his career, he had to become Michael Phelps reinvented in order to just be able to get on the doggone football field, right?
So the kind of the story behind that is, when it comes to, like, you know, just staying aware of what everyone's saying, that's really how this story started. Joe goes on the radio a lot, you know. He's on the Browns radio. He's on TV, NFL Network. He's a big media personality. And one time, a couple of years ago, I just heard him say in passing that he thought that his background as a track and field athlete, throwing the shot put, that helped him because as a pass blocker, because it all has to do with, they call it a kick set. It's, so he's a left tackle, so he kicks his left leg back, you know, and he's what, 6'7", about 6'7". So that's a big step. And the footwork, the technique, the explosiveness that he uses when he takes that step and subsequent steps allows him to keep up with the freaks of the NFL. They're all freaks, but I mean Myles Garrett.
The edge rushers are edge freaks. They're, they're
those
awesome.
Guys. Those guys are some of the freakiest of the freaks. And those guys are not easy to deal with, but Joe did it as well as anybody. And he says that it stems from that. And I think it's interesting because, like, we hear about specialization in sports and a debate. Should you want your kid, or, you know, or if you're a coach or if you're a parent, should you want a kid to, you know, play one sport or multiple sports, blah, blah. Well, well, Joe's a huge advocate of play as many sports as you can. And this is one of the reasons. The other thing was, I had heard him mention in passing in one of these radio interviews that his knee was so bad, and he had other problems too. Obviously, we know all the injury, back problems, everything that he played through. But it was one of his knees that was so bad that eventually really led him into the retirement. And in order to condition the way he did in his last couple seasons to be able to make it out there and keep his legendary snap streak intact, he had to find some way to stay in shape, and he hit the swimming pool. They had a lap pool put in the Browns facility, and he just used that to work out and said that, you know, so I wanted to know, when I heard these kind of comments in passing, I wanted to know a lot more about him because I was really interested. To me, they were unexplored angles, right? Yeah, so listening to interviews, hearing little nuggets and pieces of information along the way, oh, that's a good story idea. Light bulb goes off, and I say, I want to know more about that. Because I, you know, he didn't dive into it at all. And you don't, you know, in a radio interview, you know how it goes. You have a limited time. Yeah. And things are just glossed over. So I wanted to find out, okay, so how exactly do you think that this track and field background translated to the NFL? And would you have been the Hall of Fame left tackle you were without it, in your opinion? And then also, like, would you have made it to 10,000 consecutive snaps without swimming, without being able to stay in shape that way? And the answer to both those questions essentially were, like, this stuff would not have happened. It was kind of the perfect storm of all the talent, athleticism, work ethic, football intelligence, dedication, commitment, support system, and then these little things in his background or innovative ways, like the swimming, that he was able to use to, you know, extend his career and to keep that longevity intact.
Well, it's incredible. And in the story, you outlined it. And I can also remember Joe mentioning in passing on occasion, he had an LCL, three MCLs, two high ankle sprains, and the guy just kept trotting out there. It was just remarkable that Joe Thomas put together a string of 10,363, I believe is the number, of rattling it off at the top of my head. And I remember even asking him, so was that like 10,363 separate little auditions for Canton? And he kind of chuckled at that, but basically said that every time that ball was snapped, it was my way to show that what I put into my craft was being realized out on the field. And obviously him being in Canton is all the validation that you want. All right, Nate, let's wrap things up here and talk about another beloved Cleveland Brown. And you advocated for them to do right by him. And of course, we're speaking about Nick Chubb. And I just mentioned all those knee ligaments, and we know what happened with Nick in the second game of the season. Your point about what the Browns should do going forward as we head into 2024 and him rehabbing from this devastating circumstance that he went through. What is your point, and how should they handle this going forward, Nate?
Well, My point is Nick Chubb has done everything right with the Browns since they drafted him. I mean, he has been the model for what you'd want in terms of work ethic, low maintenance, elite production.
Humble. Yep.
Everything. I mean, a great teammate. You know, the only thing you can nitpick about Nick Chubb is that he's just not a great quote or a great interview in the eyes of many media members. However, a little thing that I've discovered with Nick Chubb is if I bring him something that interests him, he reciprocates. And I've been able to get two of the better Browns features I've ever done have been with Nick Chubb. And one was about his love of Batman before everyone really talked about it all the time. And the other was how he goes back home to his high school in Cedartown, Georgia, and works out with his old strength coach and works out with the high school football players there.
Yeah.
Like round the clock. Like that's his off season. And how, I mean, we all see the squat videos.
Oh my God. With the bar bending the way it does. Holy mackerel.
Right. That's all at his old high school weight room and the support system he has there and how it, you know, has kept him going and how, you know, he's able to get ready for season after season and be another freak among freaks from a physical standpoint. And then not only that, but just the kind of leadership and example and role model status that he has there among the players at his alma mater. So that was a lot of fun. So I asked John Dorsey in 2019 in a one-on-one in his office before training camp, if you could point to one player who most exemplifies or best exemplifies what you want a Cleveland Browns player to be. Who is it? And he hesitated. He sat there and squirmed a little bit. And I had a good rapport with John, which is why he, you know, agreed to a one-on-one for a camp preview or for a season preview. It was in camp. And he didn't want to answer because he didn't want to ruffle feathers. He didn't want
to. Well, that was his second year, right? That was Nick's second year, first year rookie. And then this was going into year number two of his career.
And keep in mind, Nick Chubb was drafted in the second round. And on the team still were the number one overall pick, Baker Mayfield.
Yep.
And he's a quarterback, as we all know. So you want him to be your number one leader in an ideal scenario, the way the sport traditionally is.
Yeah.
Handled and structured and, you know, everything. Denzel Ward is the number four overall pick. And there were a bunch of veterans on that team, you know, who John had brought in, a lot of established NFL guys. So Nick Chubb's very young in his career still. But he didn't want to say it. He didn't want to ruffle feathers. And then I said, okay, all right, let me just say this. One guy you point to and say, I want everybody to be like this guy. Like, hey, there's a young guy. Hey. Do what this guy's doing. And John said 24.
Yep.
24 meaning number 24, Nick Chubb. And it's never changed. Regime has changed. John's no longer with the Browns. He's with the Detroit Lions. Baker Mayfield, you know, got better as a leader for the Browns, I think. And then obviously he and Kevin Stefanski didn't get along and it blew up. And now he's with Tampa Bay about to face John Dorsey's Lions. So again, it all comes full circle in some way, but through it all, through the changes, through the staff changes, through the front office changes, Andrew Berry taking control, a contract extension for Nick Chubb, you know, how are guys going to react after they get the money, yada, 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 on and on and on. We've seen all kinds of people react to different things in different ways. And Nick Chubb is still, from my vantage point, been the consummate professional and the great example that John Dorsey touted very early in an NFL career that's become really remarkable. And yeah, it was a tragic injury on that September 18th in Pittsburgh. I was there with our beat writer, Chris Easterling, who's doing a great job covering the Browns for us. And we were in shock. Everybody was in shock. I went to the Steelers locker room, okay? Chris went to the Browns locker room. I went to the Steelers locker room because I wanted to actually talk to the guys who put the hit on him, okay?
Yeah.
Minka Fitzpatrick also suffered an injury and was, like, gone. He was being, I think, not 100% sure. I don't remember real clearly, but he may have gone to the hospital. He was unavailable, I think, and a lot to do with the injury. And But I was able to talk to TJ Watt, ask him a question, ask Larry Ogunjobi, a former Browns player, question, ask a couple other Steelers defenders about Nick Chubb. And obviously the Browns locker room was somber. They're devastated that he was hurt. But what really hit me was, from my perspective and what I had gained by talking to Steelers players about him and how they're like, hey, a guy like that, everyone in the NFL is going to be just heartbroken about that. Like, that was the sentiment. You know, it's not a direct quote, but that was the vibe. That was what they were saying, to paraphrase, in general. That was the feeling. And it really was hard. It was really hard. So I wish Nick the best. Obviously, he blew out the same knee when he was at Georgia. He had a remarkable comeback story to get to the NFL and be what I think was definitely the best running back for a stretch in the league. So obviously, I hope he comes back. It would be an incredible story, an incredible achievement. And I would never bet against him, because not only is he a freak physically, but I think that his work is unmatched. And everyone I've talked to has explained that in detail. And I just think that, you know, from a Browns perspective, from a business perspective, the NFL stands for, in a lot of the words of a lot of agents and executives who I've talked to over the years, it stands for two things. It could be not for long, and it could be not for long. And then the other one is no fill in the blank. I won't say the word. We'll just say no fill in the blank loyalty. No fill in the blank loyalty, not for long. I think this is the exception to the rule. I think for the Browns, you're not going to keep them in this, you know, the figure of roughly $16 million that's set up for him in his contract now. But I think you need to rework that contract, restructure that contract, and do right by Nick Chubb. If he's going to make the comeback, and I would not bet against him, if he's going to make the comeback, it must be in a Cleveland Browns uniform for everything he stood for everything he represents. There would be a lot of goodwill gained by doing right by Nick Chubb, not just with the fan base, not just with, by the way, when I drive into the Cleveland Browns Stadium, I see more Chubb jerseys than anything, even Myles Garrett.
Yep.
Not just with the fan base, would that have a lot of goodwill, but also in that locker room, because of everything that he's done in his career, on and off the field, everything he's represents and has represented and still represents. So you need to restructure. Look at the Jack Conklin situation as a model. Jack Conklin had a major injury. They got creative in a restructure and brought him back. Unfortunately, he got hurt again. Obviously, we know that could or could not be the case with Nick Chubb. We just don't know how he's going to hold up physically. But, you know, personally, as someone who's covered him and learned what he's about, not only what we see on the field with the amazing plays, but, you know, behind the scenes, I really do wish him the best and hope he makes it back full go.
Same here. Just love watching him play. And again, I retired a couple of years ago, and of course I wasn't a beat guy like you, but all the exposure I had to Nick was just, this is a first-class kid and so doggone humble. I still chuckle when I see, do you recall there was the video of him when he was getting his bags at the airport coming in as a rookie? And
that was,
what do you
hard
do?
Yeah.
It, you know, it's just hilarious. You know, it's like, I'm a running back. You know, it's just so, and again, not to knock Baker. Baker is just a different individual, more outgoing than Denzel Ward. But everybody was clamoring for Baker. And then he was just, you know, Nick was like, yeah, I played for Georgia. It was just cute as heck to see. And I wish him nothing but the best, and just love watching his career. And same for you, Nate. Keep up the great work. It's always a pleasure to see some of the stuff that you have in the paper. I'm glad that you're enjoying your enterprise reporting and feature writing aspect of your career, because I know that Browns beat is a tough one. And I said before how much I admire everybody that's done it for many, many years. So thanks for coming on the pod, first and foremost. And I wish you nothing but the best as you move forward. So keep those great stories coming, my friend.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking about it. And I'm just having a blast right now, because the Browns beat is such a grind. And for 12 seasons, I was fortunate to do it. But I needed a change of pace. You know, I've got two little kids. And so, you know, we can talk about work-life balance for a whole other podcast. And I'm sure you're well aware, John, like, you could probably give a lot of great advice to me and other people, but it's tough to manage it all. And so traveling, you know, not like an NBA or MLB rider, but still traveling a decent amount, can wear on, you know, the family life and can be tough. So for me to be able to bounce around and, you know, cover some basketball, get involved with Ryan Lewis, our Guardians, you know, beat writer, and do a little bit of Guardians and write about Tito on his way out as the manager of the Guardians. Like, that was a lot of fun. Cover some high schools, colleges, our local legends, a lot of interesting stories there. Like, I'm just having a blast. So it's been a real nice change of pace and, you know, still involved with the Browns, but nice to branch out. I've been really fortunate.
Well, all the best to you. And once again, thanks for coming on, Nate.
Thanks, John.
Thanks very much, Nate. And by the way, you will find in the archives right about January of last year, 2023, my interview with the trailblazing sports writer Marla Ridenour. She was referenced in the interview as one of the big influences for Nate in his journalistic career. And as always, folks, please follow, leave a review and comment if possible, or share the episode as well. Always helps move the needle for the podcast in all of those algorithms that I don't understand one bit of. Hope you have a great day. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Telich Talks.